Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 79. On this episode, we are talking about Bridge of Spies, the latest Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg joint. Joining me for this episode is regular of the show, Blaine Grimes. Also, anytime we do any kind of historical thing, we have to have Clay Morgan on. Clay Morgan's from The Story Men. You probably recognize him. So we have a great conversation about history and allegory and paranoia and pointing the finger and individualism, American exceptionalism. So it's really great stuff. In the meantime, guys, make sure you're checking out realworldtheology.com. Our Star Wars minisodes have just started, so be looking for those on Monday. We have great Bond reviews in honor of Spectre coming out. And speaking of Spectre, our upcoming podcast episodes will be out soon. We've got episodes on Spectre, Mockingjay Part 2 that we'll be doing, and we'll be covering The Good Dinosaur, so be looking for those. Follow us on Facebook at Real World Theology. Follow us on Twitter at Real World Theo. Subscribe to the podcast. You can look for new episodes of the podcast on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. You can find us at Feedburner, Stitcher, iTunes. So we're everywhere, hopefully, that you want us to be. Rate and review the show. Tell your friends. Let us know what you think of the show. We really appreciate it. But anyway, we have a really great show for you this time. An awesome conversation. Very historical. Very informative. So here it is. Episode 79. Bridge of Spies and Historical Allegories. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. So, okay, so one of the reasons I knew I was going to try to get you on this one, Clay, was because of the history angle. Mm-hmm. You know, anytime we're doing like the pseudo biopic, I kind of assume that it's going to have some history elements, we hope, that are actually at least moderately accurate, and that you would thus be interested. But would I be like, are you a Spielberg fan?
Oh, sure. Sure.
Where is Spielberg on your radar? Like,
totality or Spielberg from a certain era?
Dude, explore the space.
Well, walking. yeah, Spielberg is obviously one of the great American directors, and he also very clearly hit a rough patch after Catch Me If You Can for quite a few movies, where he stopped, I think, having that kind of impact that he had earlier in his career. You know, someone said that he's lost a lot of that childlike innocence and zeal since 9/11. Maybe I'm adding the since 9/11 part, but okay. I think that Spielberg is a master of his craft and technically is one of the great directors without argue in American history. I wouldn't say he's my favorite director, but certainly I have loved many of his films.
So despite the slump that you're acknowledging that he went through, if Spielberg comes out with a movie, you're going to go see it, right? Like, is he on that list of directors?
Or? Well, I mean, I still haven't seen War Horse, so there was a World War I movie, and I was like complaining about the lack of World War I movies for a long time. And so a World War I movie came out, and a Spielberg movie came out, and I still haven't seen it. So that kind of tells you that I'm willing to let it pass.
Okay, not a must. So, Blaine, basically same question. You might say the exact same question. Where, like, what is Spielberg to you? Like, is that a reason that you wanted to see this movie?
Yeah, so the first two movies I remember seeing ever, I was about 3 years old. In fact, I was 3 years old. And the first two movies I saw were Jurassic Park and Jaws, in that order, I believe. So, I mean, my first experience with movies that I can remember was as a three-year-old watching Jaws and Jurassic Park. So, I grew up with Spielberg.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing that I'm not completely insane. But yeah, I survived through that. But yeah, I grew up with Spielberg. I love Spielberg before I knew there was such a thing as a director or anything like that. And I will see and have seen everything Spielberg has made and will continue to do so just because sort of in my psyche, he's a part of my life. And he makes some darn good movies, or he has in the past. I mean, like Clay was saying, I feel like it's been a long time since I've got to see the Spielberg that I grew up with and that I love. That kind of breaks my heart, but I do love Spielberg and will see all of his movies. And on top of that, I'm a huge espionage fiction fan, especially spy dramas and things set in the Cold War. I'm a huge fan of John le Carré, and I love that sort of type of psychological espionage film. So this was kind of like a Bridge of Spies was kind of a double win for me, at least in terms of me, wanting to go see it. So yeah, I love Spielberg.
Okay, so where would I know you're saying you basically have some childlike attachment to Spielberg. Like you're holding on from childhood. I mean he's a good director, obviously. You're acknowledging that. But does he still rank among your highest directors? Like is he
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there is a director who has spanned his whose work has spanned as many genres as Spielberg's work has, and he's navigated all that different terrain successfully in many cases. So I think just in terms of the different types of films that he's directed, he's one of the best that's around. Still, even in movies like this that I'm not 100% sold on, there are sequences and there are scenes and there are shots that are just beautifully directed, masterfully directed, and that are captivating. I think you have some of those moments in every one of his films, whether or not the film on a whole is successful. I mean, he's incredibly talented, and one of the things that he's able to do really well that I don't know that he gets enough credit for is direct a really, really good long take. He does it really, really well. And he does it in a way that's not obnoxious, where it's not like, oh, look at me, I can film this all in one take. Like Joe Wright is one of those directors who feels that way to me. Whenever he does a long take, it just feels really ostentatious and showy. And Spielberg never comes across like that to me. It just feels very natural, and he's moving actors around in such a way where they're always the center of attention. They're creating new frames, and it's not just watching him do this really cool stuff with the camera, like I feel like I said, Joe Wright tends to do a little bit. Not to knock on him, but
Well, I mean, to be fair, Joe Wright has never been acclaimed as one of the greatest directors in all of cinematic history, despite his impressively long, long shot accumulation. Like if you go look at like the longest long shots, like top five's longest long shots, Joe Wright's like 3 out of 5 or something dumb like that. Like he just when you get a Joe Wright film, that's like his trademark. And it's still not something that people are really connecting with.
And it's because, like, if you think about the one that sticks out in my mind is Atonement. If you've seen Atonement,
Unfortunately.
there's that ex yeah there's that extremely, and it's a great book too. It's a great book. But there's that long take and around the Ferris wheel, and I don't remember what's going on at that point. But it's like there's not any character that you're watching during this time. You're just watching him re be really or try to be really cool and move the camera around a lot, and you're bored in about 30 seconds. And Spielberg is always able to create something really interesting and compelling to look at and to sort of drive the momentum forward when he's doing that.
Well, since you mentioned this specific thing in Bridge of Spies, because I didn't even really notice any long shots. Not that they had to be, excruciatingly long, but can you give me an example in Bridge of Spies of a long shot that you thought was done well, off the top of your
Nope.
head?
Nope.
Yep. Yep. I know I was putting
It's
you on the
been too, I've
spot.
only seen it once, and it's been several weeks now. So,
I should have planned ahead. Okay, so we switch gears slightly, and basically, I honestly want to know the same things about that we're asking about Spielberg about Tom Hanks, and it seems silly that I'm asking that, but I would throw in personally that I actually missed War Horse in the theater, but for the most part, if Spielberg puts out a movie, I will go see it. Also, much to, I know some people who probably will listen to this later, much to their chagrin, if Tom Hanks puts out a movie, I will almost always go see it. With very, very few exceptions, because I feel like even though the criticism of Tom Hanks is that he plays Tom Hanks in most of his movies, or all of his movies, depending on who's criticizing him, that he picks pretty good movies. So whether it's him or the movies that he's either a great actor or he picks great movies, I almost always enjoy the movie he's in.
Mm-hmm.
So Clay, how do you feel about Tom Hanks, and what is his box office draw to you?
Yeah, I like him. And, you know, J.R. Forrest Harris has been on your podcast a couple of times here, my co-host over at the Storymen. And so we always argue about it. But I've kind of come to peace with the fact that I just think he's a really good actor. I think he's excellent in many films. And when he's made a couple of like bad movies, it's definitely the exception. For sure, I think you know that you're getting a pretty good film. And what this movie has made me think about, kind of, I guess I put a little bit more thought into a Tom Hanks movie this time because I knew I was going to be talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that once you cast Tom Hanks as a movie maker, you've got so much of the work already done. I think that's really interesting, you know, and that people say like, well, he's like Jimmy Stewart. And I'm like, okay, well, Jimmy Stewart's like basically my favorite actor of all time alongside Cary Grant. So that's pretty awesome. And yeah, it's not about range of character in their case, right? It's not like a chameleon kind of situation, like even like a Brad Pitt or, you know, more commonly someone would talk about, I don't know, like Gary Oldman or something like that. There's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I just have really enjoyed Hanks movies. I usually will be drawn to the cheeky and quirky over the dark and dire. And, you know, outside of a disaster like The Lady Killers or a weird 2 hours of my life like The Terminal, for the most part, Tom Hanks just makes good movies. I enjoy them. And the thing about it is there is no such thing as like a Tom Hanks movie. He might be a very similar persona. He might represent, you know, a certain kind of virtue almost every single time. But he does it in such a wide breadth of stories that for me, there is a lot of diversity in my Tom Hanks life. You know, and I go back to Splash when I was a kid and Money Pit and
The Burbs.
Yeah, The Burbs. Wasn't allowed to watch Bachelor Party until I got to college, you know. I had to get out of mom's house before I saw Bachelor Party. But, you know, he did those kind of things. And then the 90s happened, and he was just kind of a guy, right? Big was this just humongous smash hit.
Oh.
And people liked Big, and which, by the way, is the first $100 million movie for a female director, Penny Marshall. And, you know, then he gets into the 90s, and all of a sudden hits a couple of just huge, huge movies, and Forrest Gump pretty much won me over. Apollo 13 maybe is my favorite Tom Hanks movie. So I've always enjoyed him. And then, you know, when someone like JR pushes against me, I'm like, okay, so I could see your point there. I could see your point there. But I still think he's a great actor and he makes really quality movies almost all the time.
So even in the stereotype of Tom Hanks, he brings like the positive side of the stereotype is you're almost getting a lot of characterization without having to actually do any characterization.
Yeah, right. I thought that was a really interesting comment on some of the roles that he's played. That, like, well, Tom Hanks is on the screen for 3 seconds. You've got the backstory covered.
Yeah, you know who his character is just because who it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, except for in that rare case that you're talking about. You know, like in Forrest Gump, obviously he's, you know, slightly different, and you know, he does waver between something like Castaway, Saving Private Ryan, but for the most part, you can tell, like, hey, he's a thoughtful, kind of, you know, positive, semi-hopeful kind of spin on life, right?
Yeah, and there's an available vulnerability that I enjoy. I like to see that kind of thing, you know, and it's in a movie like this, it's real easy to go back to like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington with Jimmy Stewart, where, you know, we could talk about the tone of this movie, and I'm sure we will, and what it was trying to accomplish. But if Spielberg definitely got the performance that he wanted, I'm sure of it.
Yeah. All right, Blaine, is Tom Hanks a draw for you?
Yeah, I mean, I can second everything that Clay said. And I think even to go back to the criticism that I think is leveled at him a lot of, well, he's just the same character. At some point, I kind of want to be like, well, who cares? It's Tom Hanks. And even if it's even if he's the same in every movie, he's charming, he's likable. He brings a sort of, you know, quality, an optimism to the films that he's in that that you just love. For me, he's kind of similar to, or I should say maybe George Clooney is similar to Tom Hanks in that way. They remind me of one another like that, right? I mean, people say that about George Clooney all the time. Well, he's George Clooney in every movie that he's in. And I'm like, well, so what? He's fun to be around. Like, he's the kind of guy you want to go hang out with. Yeah. So, yeah, I am a Hanks fan. I'm probably not as just crazy about him as some people are. I don't necessarily have to get to see everything that he's in, but I think he's great. So, yeah, and like I said, I could second everything that Clay already said.
Yeah, so obviously I think we've hit upon, or we've come to a consensus, if nothing else, that we think, you know, Spielberg is intentionally casting Hanks in this film because he wants something very specific. I would say that furthermore, that because of some of the tendencies that we've already hit on about Spielberg doesn't really let a lot of stuff just fly by. Like, he has a very specific reason for doing everything. So he's trying to set the stage in Bridge of Spies to tell us a story that has some suspense, that can be a slow burn, that's a little quirky at times, and then, you know, is probably going to ultimately maybe be not just hopeful, but maybe a little too hopeful based on the subject matter. And I think Spielberg tries to set the stage a little with, like, you know, kids watching nuclear safety videos and newspapers with crazy headlines and things like that. But Clay, since you are the history expert, because, you know, I would never tell anyone that I got a history degree if I was on with someone who taught it. This is how I bring in someone who knows
me. Hey.
Like, well, that's what I'm saying. I have a history degree. I'm not going to tell anybody about the Cold War. I'm going to leave it to the professionals, right? Okay. So I was hoping that you could kind of, like, set the scene, because this is supposed to be, you know, based on, you know, I use quote marks, right? Based on a true story. Because you basically can't make a movie in Hollywood without saying based on a true story.
Right.
I was talking to my friend who, you know, were writing a script, and it's basically a zombie movie. And I was like, just make sure at the very beginning of the movie we'll put based on a true story. because you can't get a movie made without that. So this based on a true story movie.
Like Fargo, by the way. That's like a Coen Brothers tie-in.
Yeah, exactly. Written by, yeah, exactly. Coen Brothers tie-in. So I don't necessarily think there's enough setting there. I think there's like an understanding, like people remember what the Cold War is. So I'm not going to give you as much as maybe we should. Can you kind of expand upon why people around this time would be so quick to be like, there's a spy, hang them, like no trial, no nothing, you know, basically the entire crux of the movie. And, if you want to even go further, because they definitely don't really, well, at least from what I saw, put a lot of explanation in to what the significance of Berlin in this movie.
Sure.
They're just like, oh, there's Berlin, they're kind of building a wall. Like I understood, but I didn't think they explained it very well. So what does this time period look like?
Well, it's interesting. You already kind of suggested something in your question that I thought about throughout the film. Looking around the theater and watching the film, I probably, like you guys, felt that this is not a film that a lot of 18 to 25-year-olds are running out to watch. I don't think that that's exactly Spielberg's target audience here. And for me, I think that's one of the reasons they did not do so much of the historical groundwork because they expected the people who are going to see this movie know what the Cold War is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of an interesting reality, I think, of Spielberg in that case, understanding his audience. And it probably played into some of the, if you want to call it hokey, you know, old fashioned nature of the film for sure. But the Cold War is a period of about four decades that got started after World War II in the 1940s. And it was a time in which the Soviet Union and the United States of America were the two superpowers. And the stakes were high as basically the whole world was being put back together again after this global war. And there's really, in a nutshell, the Cold War is about two different ideologies, capitalism and communism, that cannot coexist. They are fundamentally different in how they operate. And when you look at the stakes of who would get to control the countries of the world after the war, America had the money, and the Russians wanted more power. So these two countries were constantly battling it out at every turn, right? So that's like a simple way to say it, is that it was a battle of ideologies represented in these two nations. And so by the time we get to this film in the late 1950s into the early 1960s, there is a bipolar world. And Winston Churchill called it the Iron Curtain, that kind of splits Europe in half. And there's the countries that are controlled by the Soviet bloc. So that's Russia and the Soviet Union and the satellite nations that are like attached to it, like Poland and Czechoslovakia, Hungary, you know, nations that are within Moscow's grip and control. And then there are the nations that are free from that, that are more aligned with the British, the French, the Americans. So the Cold War eventually impacts the whole globe, and you could talk about things like Korea and Vietnam and on, getting to the moon and all that stuff. But the stakes right there that lead you to your Berlin question and to why there are spies flying over Russia, or why there's a Russian walking around New York with secret notes, is that they were trying to get an upper hand in this global race for dominance. And as it happens, Germany was the culprit in World War II. So it was the final country to be carved up and divided. And because the Russians and Americans disagreed over so many things, they could not unify Germany after the war. So you end up with East Germany and West Germany. And East Germany is on the Russian side, and that's the side controlled by the Russians. And Berlin is, in fact, split in half, because it's the most influential city, basically. So they have kind of like drawn an imaginary line from World War II up until the early 1960s. And it's like, okay, this is our side, says Russia, and that over there is your side for America and the British and the French and whatnot. So the biggest thing is just to kind of picture the world in terms of it being carved up after World War II. And so that's the first step. I mean, that's before the paranoia then, that when you come to believe that the Russians have spies everywhere, people got really paranoid in America. A lot of it was driven during Dwight Eisenhower's administration, which is pretty much the entirety of the 1950s. And very famously, a lot of people who have heard of like the Second Red Scare or Joseph McCarthy, there's this era called McCarthyism, which one of my favorite Jim Carrey movies, The Majestic, is all about McCarthyism. And it's a period in which there is this widespread fear that the Russians are basically secretly invading America, you know, taking over from within. And if you don't look patriotic, and if you don't go to church, and if you don't espouse publicly and clearly the values of a good, honest American, then maybe you could even come into question. And that's when you get things like the government going after high-profile things. People like Richard Nixon as a young congressman investigating Hollywood, because Nixon knows how good it is to look mean on camera against the evils of communism. And by the way, Trumbo is another movie that's coming I can't wait for, with Bryan Cranston.
Yep.
And Trumbo is all about this era. So you'll get a great look at it in there as well. So that's what McCarthyism is. It's this era of fear that the communist menace, as it was called, is taking over. I mean, even things like the Cincinnati Reds, the baseball team, they went back, they started calling themselves the Cincinnati Redlegs. If you go look at baseball cards from the late 1950s, because they didn't want to be called the Reds, because that meant you were a communist. Like, what do you do with that? And in 1957, two nuclear physicists, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, were captured, were arrested for espionage, for giving secrets of the atomic bomb program, the Manhattan Project, to Russian scientists, to the Russian government. And in fact, the Rosenbergs were actually executed. It was an electric chair execution, and it was super controversial, even at that time, even with, you know, the public so against communism. So that's an important piece of the setting that we step into with this story.
So what, when you, oh, I just want to have that little sound effect. That's like the more, you know, like, but when you, so when you go through all that stuff, I can't help but think about and wonder how intentional it may or may not have been that this certainly can like this story can resonate with us in a post 9/11 America.
Yes.
The like, what is your neighbor doing? The, is it okay to, you know, what kind of surveillance is okay? At what point do I give up my freedom for security? You know, is my neighbor going to church? You know, it, just all this stuff of paranoia, paranoia, paranoia. And given, I think we've, you know, we're years out from 9/11 now, and it's probably not quite as bad on a personal level, though I would say on a global level, it's probably worse than it's ever been. It just, the parallels are striking. Blaine, did you ever really like get that parallel when you were watching the film about like maybe like Spielberg trying to make some kind of statement about a post 9/11 America?
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of what I wrote about in my review. And that's what a lot of these, I would argue that's what a lot of these Cold War films are doing these days. They're set in the Cold War. They use that historical setting, but they're actually using that to explore what it means to live in a post 9/11. And I would even say a post Edward Snowden society, right? Where we know that the government is collecting all of this information, that they're listening to us right now, that they're doing all of these things. That's what these films are really, really interested in exploring. And that's nothing new. Using a sort of historical setting to explore a present or a contemporary issue isn't anything new. I mean, if you even think back to Arthur Miller's iconic and anthologized The Crucible, it's set in Puritan New England, but it's very much about McCarthyism. So this isn't anything new, but yeah, I do think it was pretty obvious that this is really what Spielberg is interested in exploring in this film.
Can I ask Blaine, because I read your review and I thought it was really well written, and Mikey, this question's for you too, but that's what I felt the first 45 minutes, hour of the film. I thought we were getting like a really interesting look and a critique of post-World War II America, but then it seems like we didn't. In the end, it seemed like it kind of bailed on that.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. I think it tried to do a lot of things that, like you said, it either bails on it just it, or that just don't come across. I would agree with that.
Yeah, there was this critique that I read of the film that talked about how it seemed like it was basically two separate films. And I would say that especially once they start really bringing in the Gary Powers story, that it kind of takes like a right turn and doesn't really finish what it started. Or if it does, it was never, it lingered too much in this, this post 9/11 allegory without finishing it. And that was a bit frustrating because I felt like they could really go somewhere with it. I mean, you have Tom Hanks standing up and kind of grandstanding these speeches, to the Supreme Court, you know, to you know, at every level of our justice system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually he's basically in front of the Supreme Court talking, you know, talking about, you know, do we stand by our cause less resolutely than he stands by his, you know, like, why are we America? What do we really stand for? Is fear mongering what this country was built on? Or he's, you know, he's implying, not flat out saying, but he's saying it in a very legal, well-reasoned kind of way.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, so make America deal with that. Like, take that one step further. But then it turns back into the insurance angle where it's like, well, let's just keep him around just in case. And isn't that convenient that I'm using this storytelling device to really talk about the exchange? And so then it becomes about the exchange, and it doesn't become about ideologies anymore.
Yeah. I mean, there's that moment on the plane, you know, so we got to talk about Gary Powers, and this is, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But so Gary Powers is the American who's captured. And so this is what's at stake, that America has a captured Russian and the Russians have a captured American. And at the end, Powers feels like he's coming home disgraced and ashamed. And he's sitting there just so worried about now he's got his freedom, but he's got to go face. Everybody's going to think he was a coward for not killing himself before he was captured. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, and Jimmy Donovan's kind of like, do you know that you did the right thing? Then who cares what anybody else thinks? It was it was just kind of a weird moment. And I thought that Hanks was at his best when he was actually in the diner at the booth with the FBI agent. And the guy's like, you know, it's all the same. We're all the same. And he's like, no, we're not. Like, there is this American ideal based in the Constitution, and these rights actually matter. And that scene, it was, again, like The Majestic. They managed to do this movie where they showed the real cruel kind of communist witch hunts that happened. And, mm-hmm. And in the end, Jim Carrey, of all people, gives this like really impassioned speech about the Constitution, but they still end it on like this cynical tone. And he's like, well, yeah, you didn't just win because you gave a good speech about the Constitution. You actually gave a name and, you know, yada, yada, which I really like. I really like that film. But I just felt like the scene on the plane and the scene in the diner, there was just some kind of like tonal inequality there. Like Blaine said, it's, you know, maybe it was two different movies. It's hard to say as much without it, with only seeing it once.
No, I like you reminding me of the scene in the diner, because I think that is probably the epitome of what you're talking about. You know, we have a character who starts down a path, and I think it helps because that's the part where, like, I think Donovan kind of pushes all his chips to the middle and says, okay, I can see what kind of pushback. This isn't cool. I have to decide where I'm at. And, you know, it becomes the image that we get later, the standing man. But I feel like, why have that in there if you're just going to make the second half of the movie about the swap instead? Is it an allegory movie, or is it a, you know, negotiation movie, like a thriller? You know, is it a courtroom drama, or is it a thriller? And not that it can't necessarily be both, but it just, I don't know, tonally it switched too much. Like, we're... Oh gosh. So Blaine, did it have, like, were those the two tones that you saw throughout the film? Like, where do you land on this?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, it seems like in some way it couldn't decide which one it wanted to be. And you know, I was hoping, kept hoping for more of these thrillers. And ways the climax, you know, it seemed dissatisfying because it acted like it was building towards sort of a thriller-esque climax, and it never really delivers on that, and then sort of goes for this sort of melodramatic.
Are you talking about the Bridge of Spies part of the Bridge of Spies?
Well, I mean, so are there, do we actually, oh man, how do I ask
this? Yeah.
Do we actually learn a lesson at the end? Like, do we actually, like, I feel like we, you know, like we talk about the ending of a movie all the time. So if you don't know that by now, congratulations, now you know. At the end of this film, like, we have people creepily smiling at Tom Hanks and being like, oh, I guess we made the right decision. But people don't actually learn that, like, wanting to, like, hang a person or like going on these witch hunts is wrong. They just go, oh, at least he didn't, he redeemed himself, I guess, in our eyes. But like basically Spielberg is having Tom Hanks redeem himself to this thing that we're not for in the first place. So it's like, why are we hopeful about this? Why are we happy that all these people finally accept Tom Hanks for doing something that wasn't really the point in the first place? The people are still wrong. They're just not mad about it anymore.
That scene on the train, like, definitely, it stole the thunder from the conclusion for me. Like, it, I was enjoying sitting in the discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't even talked about Mark Rylance, who plays Rudolf Abel, who is the Russian spy, and who is the best part of this movie, in my opinion, by a mile. But,
and many other smart, educated, well thought out critics' opinions as well.
Good. I mean, I didn't even know he was just incredible, right? And mm-hmm. so, right before the exchange, Jimmy Donovan says to Rudolf Abel, "How will I know that you're going to be okay?" And you know, he says, "When they greet me, look for whether or not they hug me or just show me the back seat of the car." And so, you know, not surprisingly, the exit of the greatest character in this film is the most poignant movie in a lot of ways, poignant moment in a lot of ways for me, because he's not greeted with a hug. He's shown the back of the car, and the intimation is that he's going to go be interrogated, distrusted, and perhaps even tortured and killed. And so I guess, you know, you're trying to juxtapose that, if you're Spielberg, against, like you said, it doesn't make sense, right? It's not about the American public changes. It's just that this guy, Jimmy Donovan, is kind of vindicated in that bus scene. And I don't know. It's just, it's part of why it's not a movie that will resonate. It's just like a nice film. It was shot well. It looks great. It's acted smartly, and I'm not going to watch it again. But I mean, it's not like The Monuments Men, which was like just dumpster fire last year. You know, it's like, if you make me hate a history movie, you are really
working hard.
At a high level of incompetence.
Yeah, it's I would say it's probably, like, for as much as I personally have issues with war, if you make a war film that I don't like, you've done something terribly wrong, because I would sit and watch like Operation TNT as a kid. Like, I'm 13 sitting in front of like watching these John Wayne movies. It's hard to make a bad war film. And if you make a bad war film, what are you doing? You make a bad history film? Come on.
Right. And this was not a bad history film. This was a very well done history film. But, you know, I certainly wouldn't say that it was an A. It wasn't in the grade A range.
Well, okay, so does Spielberg's hopefulness work against him? Because this is the issue that I had. Like, Saving Private Ryan is like 94%, well, probably 96%, one of my favorite movies ever, for so many reasons. But in Saving Private Ryan, Spielberg tacks the scene on right at the end, just of, you know, of old Matt Damon saying, like, "Tell me I earned this."
Oh, yeah.
"Tell me." And I'm like, why? Why did we need that?
Really?
Like we know, like, all he had to do was break down. Like, we didn't need him saying these things. We didn't need him doing, like, we got that. Like, you crafted such a beautiful picture of someone getting this thing that they can never repay. And
you know, I like that ending personally.
Oh, come on. So they have this thing that, you know, he can never repay, but then Spielberg like says, "Okay, just guys, just in case you didn't understand, he's having to wrestle with this fact that he has a debt that he can never repay." And so I feel like the same thing in this. It's like Spielberg's trying to make this film so hopeful. He's trying to have a positive spin on what's happening so much that he actually betrays the argument that he could have had through the entire film. And that was that America just wasn't getting it right. Like, we weren't the good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever get annoyed? Apparently Clay doesn't, but Blaine, do you ever get annoyed that Spielberg's too hopeful?
In general, it doesn't bother me that Spielberg is. It bothers me that Spielberg was in this instance, because I don't think this kind of movie calls for it or even functions best with it. I mean, a lot of, and Clay, you can kind of correct me on this. Most Cold War films, or most espionage films set in the Cold War, work really well because they're pessimist. I mean, they're pessimistic and they're looking at pessimistic times. They're not these great tales of triumph and humanism and all of these things. And Spielberg kind of acted like he wanted to jump in that pool, right? Like we said, kind of with the first act of the movie. It's like he tries to get in here and say, hey, maybe we're not perfect. Maybe Americans aren't perfect. Maybe we don't have all this figured out. And then, like I say in my review, it ends up being like, well, we have Tom Hanks, so we've got a lot of it figured out.
And that's pretty good.
And we know in the end that, like, at least we can smile at Tom Hanks in the end. Like, at least we know we're wrong, so that means we're really not all that bad. Like, it's never willing to fully commit. And I think some of the best Cold War espionage films, or some of the best espionage films out there are willing to go that extra mile.
Well, it particularly,
I mean, at the same time, a lot of times those are very, go ahead.
Sorry about that.
Go ahead, Clay.
I think it particularly feels good to kind of like, you know, brush off that veneer because it was an era where truth was so masked in this appearance and so many people were basically, you know, hurt by the need of the government to just really violate rights in a substantial way. The First Amendment was just stomped all over in the 1950s. That now that we can, it feels good to kind of go back and vindicate some of those folks who were done wrong. And I'm sure that Cranston's going to bring a lot of that in Trumbo, for example. But I think you just – there's like this instinct that there's something a little bit dirty if in the end I feel good about what the governing authorities were doing at this time. And I think the way that Spielberg felt that he would be able to get away with it – and again, it's not – this isn't terrible. This isn't a huge failure. It's just a weird kind of imbalance in the story. But the fact that Jimmy Donovan was sent not as a representative of his government and that we get to see him be a little bit of a maverick and he kind of goes on his own and he decides to take up for this other student who has also been detained by the Russians, that we can root for somebody who is in fact bucking that American government and that's why we can celebrate Donovan. I'm sure that's what Spielberg was trying to do, right? And that's why it's important on that bus, because the American people represent their government at that time, and we want to see somebody buck that trend. And that's why this is an amazing story to tell. I did not know about Jimmy Donovan, and it was rightly brought to Hollywood, you know? So it's supposed to be a critique against the ruling power of the time, because this is a guy who didn't officially work for the government. He actually did what he wanted, and he made the FBI and the Secretary of State, you know, State Department, kind of work for him in the end. And but I think that's where we kind of sense the tension is, like, what exactly am I supporting when I feel good at the end of this in some ways?
I think there's this almost compound sentence of, because America, comma, because individualism, like at the end of the day, one person is making a difference, right? Like one person can speak better than the entire American government, as long as he's American. But he doesn't really need anyone else. He knows better than the FBI. He knows better than the CIA. You know, he knows better than the actual governing powers. He can take it to a level that they can't. And it seems to put this idea of an individual as, once again, if we could all just be exceptional individuals, then I guess America would be exceptional. Maybe that's a bit of a stretch. But I think with this whole, what do they call it? I don't know how you pronounce it, like stoiky music or something, like the standing man, this thing. It's about like one person standing up.
Blaine, was it you that I'm not sure. I read so many different reviews that somebody was saying that Spielberg and Hanks are like the Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart combo of today. I don't know if that was Blaine or someone else I was reading said that, and I got to think about that some more before.
Yeah, that wasn't me.
Okay.
Yeah.
but if Clay liked it, you should just take it. I'm pretty sure that was me.
Clay has to think about it, but certainly Frank Capra loved telling stories of the underdog, right? He loved telling the story of the average man, especially the family man, who could overcome really insurmountable, seemingly insurmountable odds and warm our hearts with some kind of success. And in one of the reviews that I was reading in this way, there was this talk that it's really about civic duty, that Spielberg celebrates somebody who takes up and does their civic duty. And this is also the guy that made Munich, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. I don't know that he's the Frank Capra, but and Munich is a powerful film. I don't mean to criticize it, but just I don't know if that's just what it is. To your point, Mikey, that like as soon as if it wasn't for Mark Rylance giving that speech about the standing man,
mm-hmm.
I think that I would have started to hate the movie right in that scene because the way he delivered the story of how his this family friend came over and stood in the face of the oppression by the Germans, like the way he delivered that scene, just that was like everything in this movie, and it worked because of that performance by Rylance. But those words in a less gifted actor's mouth, it could have killed the whole movie for me, because then I'm like, oh, here comes Stoicky Man at the end, because he stands stands and he's not gonna budge until they get the call. But it was kind of cool on that bridge, so I don't know.
Yeah, so I was gonna bring up Munich, and it's probably been 3 years since I've seen it. Is it as like I want to go out and buy an ice cream cone after I'm done? Like, I didn't remember it being as optimistic as this film is.
You want to just rock gently in your shower when it's over.
Right. Yeah.
but things are still kind of okay.
It's brutal. Did you say you have or have not seen it, Blaine?
I haven't seen it in about 3 years.
Yeah, it's been longer than that for me. And that's not a movie I just like revisit on a Friday night with popcorn. So, you know, that's almost like that's like a revenge movie, you know. And it's I think that one comes from. You know, Spielberg borrowing from obviously his Jewish heritage, and I remember being really fascinated with it when it came out, but it's a whole different vibe than this.
Yeah, well, and I remember around the time there was a lot of controversy about that because it seemed like he was playing in this morally gray area that he mm-hmm. doesn't want to go in here, where it was like, you know, did they do what was right? Did they do the right thing in exacting this vengeance? So I don't know. I guess that's why this Bridge of Spies is so puzzling to me. And I guess, like you said, I'm never going to want to see it again because it's not willing to go there. And it seems like he's shown at least once before he can do that, and he could do it pretty well if I remember correctly. Hmm. So yeah, I don't know.
So I guess the thing that I'm still having trouble with is. That balance between elevating the individual and encouraging someone to stand up for what's right, like even in underdog situations. Maybe I can call back to our Selma podcast a little bit. Like, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. was an underdog, but he was doing it as a representative of something much larger. And so he wasn't just like, I, as Martin Luther King, don't like being spit on and beaten and oppressed, so I'm just going to buck the system for system bucking's sake. He's doing it, hopefully, as part of, you know, a much larger ideology, and his ideology, you know, was rooted in his faith. And so I guess especially with like movies that can kind of hit on that American exceptionalism, I get very weary, or you know, just a little hesitant when we start elevating like that individual that can go to Germany, find his way around Berlin, negotiate this thing, and, you know, chup, clap, 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 you know, back on the train, everyone's smiling, wife's now happy with him, children are super impressed, you know, look at how awesome Tom Hanks is. And, you know, given Tom Hanks is awesome. So, and it's impressive what he does, but like I said, there's that tension there for me where, I think it was a real gospel. In his review, I believe it's Sam, I can't remember. He was talking about how what he really saw in this film was like this encouragement from Donovan's character that, you know, when you stand for something, people will often hate you. If it's not the popular thing, but it's the right thing to do. And, you know, he references Matthew 10, you know, the world will hate you because you are my followers. And so as Christians, you know, we often wonder why we have a message that's not very super popular, especially in, you know, current culture, especially when we're bucking a trend, you know, maybe we shouldn't kill everybody. Maybe we should try to serve them first. You know, that's not really popular. Especially if you're a Muslim or, you know, from a different country that we disagree with. And so, like, I can understand, but when you're doing things like that, you're part of a larger group. You are acting individually, but with an ideology that's larger. And I talk myself in circles here to basically ask you guys, I mean, like, does that line never go back and forth for either of you guys? Do you not worry when we start elevating the individual that high? Or do we see Bridge of Spies as a movie that puts him in context of fighting for what's right and we can just get behind it?
Well, you know, he's the selfless servant, and it's the fact that he can't even tell the truth to his family, and we get the satisfaction of his family watching the TV at the end, and that makes us feel good, right? Because he's now getting his reward. Even though he just wants to go pass out.
So should it, though?
Right. I know that's what you're saying. And, you know, for me, it's hard for me to, like, kind of go to the spiritual themes of this film. I just don't feel it. Maybe it's too much in my wheelhouse of history and political science. I kept hearkening back to John Adams, to Paul Giamatti playing John Adams on HBO miniseries, the David Pollack book that was adapted.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, right? The evil British soldier is captured, and everybody in town wants this guy hanged. And John Adams is like, the high ideal that we value here is the rule of law. It is the right of everyone to have an honest defense, to have an unbiased verdict, you know, a jury. And in this case, that's where the pressure is in the first act of the movie, really, right? Alan Alda, his boss, is basically like, "Hey, your job is just to go stand next to this dude. We need to put a good face to getting him convicted. And yeah, that probably means execution, but who cares?" And the ideals there in this movie aren't presented at all, really, as anything, you know, Judeo-Christian. It's just, it's actually one man who's standing against a collective that is bloodlusty. So if the one man stands against what is evil, we celebrate it, you know. And I think what you're saying is the discomfort for you is, does this character in particular get rewarded as an individual for the wrong reasons? And I think that the movie would say he did what was right. He served his country, and we celebrate that.
I can be okay with that, because as long as it to me points to something greater than just the individual, like acknowledging the fact that we don't operate like in a bubble.
Right. But at the same time, we say like, yeah, we shouldn't stand out, right? The collective, but the collective in America at the time was like, it was a phony veneer, like I said. So we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. because he stood up against a collective society of racism and oppression. So, so do we not celebrate, James Donovan when he says, you know what, I'm not just going to take the easy path here and get back to my high profile lawyer job. I'm going to actually like do something that's right for this guy. But also, oh, by the way, pragmatically, like, this is just smart. If they get one of our guys, don't you want this bargaining chip?
Yeah, so to me, it would come down, not even arguing that Donovan didn't do what I would hope people would think was right, right? But when the story is told, I wish I could think of a great example off the top of my head, but, you know, if something great happens, like you're playing like some type of sport with lots of your friends and, you know, your team wins, but when you come back and tell the story to a girlfriend or a wife or your mom or, you know, whatever age is appropriate, the person that you tell it to, like, do you tell the story in a way that elevates the individual performance that you had, maybe even bolstering some of your own personal prowess? Or do you acknowledge that you acted well? I feel like I am splitting hairs now. That you did a good job individually for something that was greater than yourself. And I think it's how you tell the story. And so the first part of Bridge of Spies, and I think this goes back to the two stories that we're telling, the first third or however long, 45 minutes that we've kind of pointed out where it's the one story, I think it's Spielberg telling a story about an individual who stands up against evil or a bad ideology. And we can get behind that. But then when it switches to like him, it's just like a story about a dude who just goes and is awesome about how awesome he is. And it makes me uncomfortable. And I don't know why it makes me uncomfortable.
But that's why he doesn't tell his wife. Like he's willing to be hated by everybody, even though they don't understand.
He didn't have to tell his wife. He puts on the news, man.
He didn't put on the news. Yeah.
No, I'm not. I didn't do that. I'm not bragging. I'm letting everyone else brag for me. He's like a Dallas Cowboy, you know?
Yeah, man. I guess that's the thing I didn't understand about this film is it's supposed to inspire, and it just didn't inspire me at all. And I think maybe this is kind of related to what you were getting at is... I didn't find it inspiring, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that. But one, I never felt like there was ever any real sort of palpable tension for Donovan's character in this film. I mean, sure, people kind of made ugly faces at him on the bus, which if he was, you know, five, that probably would have really, really upset him.
Well, they attack at his house, right?
They attack at his house. Somehow his, like, the relationship with him and his family is strange. Like, somehow they're not upset at him. Like, it's not like, it's very downplayed, this decision that he's got to make to like, leave his family and possibly go die over there. I just felt like some of those elements were sort of underdeveloped. And it almost felt like nothing was at stake. It didn't give me, beyond the fact that it's Tom Hanks and he's doing a great job in this role, I'm talking about as far as how it's written, it didn't give me anything to invest in or to even challenge me so that it can inspire me.
So and I don't surprise think... you since it's written by the Coens?
I guess so. And it's not that I get that this is, like, this movie's, you know, aiming for the Oscars, and it's aiming for, like Clay said, sort of a middle-aged to older audience. And it is largely an American audience, probably. So I'm a fan of Tarkovsky, but I don't expect that this film should have had everybody dying and, you know, everybody crying in the end. I'm not looking for it to do that, but to have some sort of real stake, something to challenge me as a viewer. And I just felt like it played it very, very safe.
I don't disagree.
It would have been interesting if this movie had the same tone as Catch Me If You Can instead. You know, I don't know. Maybe you can't do that. I mean, that was a true story.
Serious but playful?
I mean, that was a true story set in a similar era. And, I don't know, probably equally without any notable women characters. But Yeah, the Coen brothers angle was interesting. I think that was real intriguing for me that the Coen brothers were working with Spielberg. And I don't know, maybe the expectations were just a little bit different. But again, it's not like I walked out feeling like I'd wasted anything. I just kind of walked away saying, oh, that movie just happened. I'm glad that some – I'm always happy when history is done well. If I were still in the classroom, I'd be telling my 20th century world students, my US 2 students, my Western Civ 2 students, hey, go check out that film. Like it's an interesting look at what America might have been like and was like back during the Cold War. And it's done well, you know, go check it out. But they wouldn't have gone to see it because Seth Rogen isn't in it and it's slow. And I would have been like, okay, extra credit for anybody that goes and sees it. And then when it comes out on DVD, a lot more students would take advantage of the extra credit because they could sit at home and just kind of throw it on. So, you know, it's like, well, Monuments Men is going to make people probably hate history more. So at least this will not hurt the cause of history. So I can behind that.
Yeah. Well, and see, for these, I normally try to go see the movie twice. And especially since this one was several weeks ago when I went and saw it, and I didn't hate the movie, but I really couldn't get myself to go see it again.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you know, it's what, 2 hours, a little over 2 hours or something. I'm like,
oh, it's like two, it's like 2.5, 2:40.
Yeah, I'm like, I can't do it.
And with that ringing endorsement, we hope you've also enjoyed Bridge of Spies, and or if you haven't for some reason seen it and have listened to this entire podcast. Well, then at that point, let's start kind of wrapping it up then, because I want to give a chance for a final thought, which is where I want you to flesh out some of the things that you guys are both hitting on, and I want to get to that before we go too long. But to transition, and tonally, I think Blaine has already gotten us here. We always like to talk about the things that we just didn't like about the movie. And I know we've all kind of said it was like, you know, it was like a perfectly fine movie. But there's something about it. There's obviously problems. There's obviously things that didn't sit right with us because we don't want to go see it again. And I think, you know, it seems pretty universal. Like, I'm fine if I don't really see this movie again. So what was it that you wish was changed or just made you say, come on, or what are you doing? Blaine, what was it that just stood out to you like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing, and we've talked about it plenty, is just how the thing that annoyed me the most is when it starts out trying to do this social critique, and then it completely dodges and whiffs. That's what made it where I don't want to see it again. There's nothing lasting there for me because it kind of pulls its punches. So yep. That's it in a nutshell.
I mean, obviously, because we keep going back to it that well so many times, it's obviously prominent. Clay, what didn't do it for you?
I mean, it was just a drama without enough drama. There was, like Blaine said, the stakes weren't high enough, even though it's life and death. And I mean, they worked in real footage of the construction of the Berlin Wall, and I've watched those clips 100 times over the years, and I know that when I watch a documentary or the true story of the Berlin Wall being constructed, it's riveting and it's heartbreaking and it moves me. And this movie didn't really do that. You know, the most compelling kind of like Le Carré moment where I felt like I was in a spy movie, and it's not a spy movie. It's a movie about the role of espionage in history. It's a drama. But the most compelling moment like that was when he had to make it into East Berlin and get to the secret meeting. And he's sick, it's cold, he comes up against some roughs, and you know, that was a compelling sequence for me because when you're crossing the border into East Berlin, that means something, and I thought it was fascinating. But other than that, it just probably should have been a 2-hour movie, or, you know, an hour 40. Even as much as I enjoyed a lot of the history of it, and even like you said, some of those justice system machinations, like that kind of gets me going because I'm a political science dork. Mm-hmm. It just was too slow.
Yep. So I feel like part of the issue was And so this happens a lot, I feel, recently, and I don't want to be a broken record about it, but it's almost like this would have been a better, like, one season HBO thing. You know, like, give it 8 episodes or something like that. Really flesh out the characters themselves, get some of that backstory that Blaine was talking about, you know, like the family piece, you know, like where they come from, how do they get there, why should people care so much? And then it's almost like you could tell all these different stories that are going on. You could more, like, it wouldn't seem so odd when we're cutting to, like, Gary Powers looking at the U2 and flying over and then getting shot down, kind of like all as like a backdrop. Or we're introduced to, and I do write this down, to Frederick Pryor, the student. We're introduced to him, like, very briefly, and you're like, I guess we're following this guy because he matters, but we're never really told why he matters, and then while we get his shots of him in jail, so we're never, at least, well, besides the fact that I'm told that he's a human being, and I hopefully care for all human beings. Like, we never really care for Pryor. We never really, besides the fact that he's an American, you know, we never really understand why Donovan is so set on it, besides the fact that it's the right thing to do. It's like, you know, so if this is like a mini series instead, then we get time to flesh all these things out, and by the conclusion, we really get a payoff. Or we get to weave some of those themes that we saw in the first part throughout the second part as well. At least that's how I would hope it would play out if we had that much time. And I just think there's too much to do, too many stories to tell, too many moving pieces to fit this into a movie, which is why we get a movie that's longer than it probably should be, because it's telling more story than it really needs to. Because, as we pointed out, it's probably more than one movie. Outside of that larger critique, again, one of my favorite things is going to the movies with my wife, because for this part of the show, it's becoming easier and easier to know what my come on moment is, because it's the part in the movie when she looks at me and rolls her eyes and basically mouths the words, come on, which was on the train when that creepy, creepy lady is staring at Tom Hanks and freaking everyone in the theater out a little bit. Because I'm like, was that supposed to be comforting? Because that was just creepy, old lady. So I could have done without that for various reasons. Most of all because it's creepy. Uh-huh. And then all the other reasons that we've hit onto the show. So moving to uplifting. Moving to more positive things. We're going to really Spielberg the end of this podcast and have a little bit of hope sprinkled in. Even if it's unearned. So.
Well, again, it's not unearned, right? It's a fine movie. It's probably a B.
Well, the hopefulness unearned. Like, what are we talking about? Is this even
criteria? Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefulness. Favorite moment, Clay. What was your favorite part of this movie?
I mean, the Bridge of Spies part was pretty cool.
an entire bridge made of spies. Actually, I would highly recommend, even like, I would say not to interrupt, but I'm intentionally interrupting. If anyone hasn't seen Tom Hanks and Jimmy Fallon,
yeah,
oh, that was great.
All of those kids' theater things are great. Oh. So that one in particular is pretty,
yeah,
awesome.
The especially that last one. But anyway, so if you haven't seen that, Tom Hanks reading the kid scripts or kid theater with Jimmy Fallon about Bridge of Spies is incredible. Clay, continue.
Man, it's so hard, right? There's a lot of neat little moments. Like, that's the thing with this movie, is like, oh, that's neat, or that's funny, or that's interesting. But actually, it's probably a sad moment, and it's so as somebody who has seen the documentation of what the Berlin Wall was and how its construction came along and what it meant and everything, seeing that brought to life, that's not something that has really appeared in a major American motion picture too often. Certainly not to the level it was reconstructed, and how they made Berlin in 1962 look in this film. It's like I said, it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. And when they're on the train, I mean, they actually, I don't know if you recall, but there was on the train, they see a person get shot trying to escape. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm referring to. But there's actually a moment where they show a woman hanging from a window. It's one of the most iconic true things that happened. I showed it to every class I ever taught in that era. and they actually recreated and blocked out the entire scene. Like it just happens in the background of Frederick Pryor, but it's real. It's like it's a real iconic moment, and they did it. And it was the kind of thing where, like, I'm looking around, like, where's all the history teachers I used to know? Like, this is amazing. I can't believe how incredible Berlin in 1962 looks. So for me, it was probably that, because I think that, especially if you talk about modern relevance, man, there's a lot of reason that we need to understand exactly what the Cold War was, exactly what it meant, and all of the fallout that we are still dealing with in 2015 that came directly from it. And certainly as Russia is still a considerable player in international affairs, but to see what happened in East Berlin is really important, and that it was done that well. I hope it's not lost. You know, that's why I said I want to see a movie like this that celebrates history and does it so well be seen by a lot of people who are under 50.
So that feels like I get to come in, swoop in, and do the low-hanging fruit, which is you're basically saying those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, or destined to repeat it, right?
It's truth.
So...
I mean, technically, those who know history are also doomed to repeat it, but that's a whole other lecture.
Yeah. Well, that's biblical, man. That's biblical. Nothing new under the sun, right? All right, Blaine, positive.
So, yeah, I'm not quite done with Clay yet, because I want to know, since I've got a history professor here, if you could recommend one introductory, sort of not terribly academic text on the Cold War, what would it be?
Oh man, normally these questions terrify me because there are so many books and I always go blank on this one. But as it happens, I have the best answer for you.
There you go.
The Cold War by Clay Morgan.
The author and the professor is named John Lewis Gaddis, G-A-D-D-I-S. And while it appears he's an Ivy League professor from Yale, it appears that he has been moving, I think, towards like a more conservative direction as he's aged. Gaddis is kind of the best historian of the Cold War. And a few years ago on campus, many years ago now, over a decade, some students walked up to him and said, "Professor Gaddis, you're really brilliant. And it would be amazing if you would write a book that like normal people could actually read easier." And he already written, like, every time documents became declassified, he would write a new Cold War book. So in 2006, he actually published The Cold War, A New History. And he wrote it with the scholarship of a brilliant professor, but the accessibility that those students wanted. And I found it to be one of the best reads on the Cold War.
Awesome. That's actually the book that I have on my nightstand right now, so I win.
Good job. Have you got into it yet?
No, not yet. Not yet.
What's that, a new?
So there you go.
For a big research project.
Is that a new history of the Cold War?
It's just called The Cold War, A New History.
Cold War, A New History. I Yoded that one, sorry. Cold War, A New History.
Okay, so my favorite part, or the best part.
Yes.
The closing credits were great. No, I'm just kidding.
I liked it when it was over. No, we're not doing monuments, man. We already took those.
So I guess I'm figuring out in doing these podcasts with you. I guess I'm kind of a shot oriented guy, because this isn't going to be the first time I've like actually got a single shot out of, you know, a 2-hour movie that really stuck out to me. But I've got one. I've got a single shot that I really, really liked, and that I wish the whole movie could have done what this one shot did. And it's on the Bridge of Spies, right during the exchange. And I believe it's after the exchange is over, and Hanks is standing there doing his standing man thing. And it's a long over the head shot outside of the bridge itself. And
like the beams are in the way a little bit.
Beams. I was trusses beams. Yeah, the beams. He's basically right in between some of the beams, and they're coming in diagonally. And I think it's a brilliant, and there's some really cool shadow play. I think it's a brilliant shot, because it's sort of able to capture that morally gray area that was the Cold War. Anytime you see
either a canted angle on the camera or you see diagonal lines in the frame, that's usually trying to signal some sort of conflict that something's not right. And then, of course, when you've got shadows there, that only intensifies it. And it's just it is a beautiful, beautiful shot. It's one of those Spielberg moments in maybe a movie that's not, or that's certainly not one of his best. But I absolutely love that shot. I would almost watch that movie again just to get to that shot, unless somebody would screen grab it for me.
Well, I was going to say, so this means that we're going to get a Bridge of Spies in one shot from Blaine, right?
There you go.
Which, if you follow Blaine on anything, you'll get. Follow him on his things, which we'll talk about in a minute. So favorite moments, I was surprised. I kind of thought you guys would go ahead and take this since we basically already mentioned it, but probably my favorite thing about this film was Mark Rylance. It seems like it would be so easy to play that character as not as aloof instead of like this, like there's an acceptance to his character. Like, I did what I was supposed to. I knew the consequences. There's no, like, you know, a character that made peace with what he was and what he was doing could have so easily been played, like I said, as indifferent or aloof, but he keeps it interesting.
What's his line every time? He's like, "You don't seem worried."
Would it help? You know, and a line like that, it's almost so cheeky that it would be dumb, but it, you know, it works every time, even when you know it's coming there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like I said, I think it's very hard to pull that off. And as much as I basically like Tom Hanks in almost everything that he's in, and I thought he totally, you know, Hanks the crap out of this performance as well, you know, active verb Hanksing to Hanks
to Hanks,
yeah, to Hanks, is Hanksing, will Hanks in the future.
Have you seen JR's thank you cards? It's actually a picture of him and it says T period Hanks. Thanks. They're awesome.
No, I want one. I haven't done anything to deserve one. It's the T Hanks card that I deserve, but not the one that I need right now. So his performance, Rylance's performance, I think sealed the heart of this movie. Like, the reason that we're rooting for anything in this movie, I think, is less because of an ideal that we agree with, which is that hypothetically we want everyone to have a fair trial and justice is served. I think less so than that. We just won't, you know, we never really wrestle with the fact that Mark Rylance's character, who I wrote down, Abel.
Rudolph Abel.
Yep. That Abel actually may have done some terrible things. We just don't know because we never explore that in the film, right? He may have actually done terrible things before he was caught, and he may have gone on to do terrible things after. The story never actually tells us that. Obviously, we can look those things up in history to a certain degree, but...
Well, by the way, he outlived Jimmy Donovan by a year.
Really? So. but the story never covers that, but we love him so much in the film that we were rooting for him. Which I think, you know, is intentional because we want to show that, where the audience can see that he's a human, even though the Americans cannot.
Casting was everything in this movie.
So,
yeah.
So, Clay, do you have any final thoughts that might be statements like casting is everything in this movie?
Well, there's one. If I quote myself from mere moments ago. I think that everyone should go see this movie. While I am not going to be as adamant in my endorsement as I was for Spielberg's Lincoln, which is, again, you talk about casting being everything, but just an amazing history done at the highest cinematic level. This is history done at a very high cinematic level. If the storytelling leaves you somewhat conflicted in how to feel, what you can still take away from this movie is that it was it was an era in which a lot of people weren't exactly sure how to feel, where people who kissed their kids every night and went to church on Sunday found themselves wishing that a married couple was fried in the electric chair. It was a confusing time. And so if there's any kind of, I guess, thematic redemption in the film for Spielberg, it's in that nobody's saying it's easy to tell stories about the Cold War, but it's important that we are telling them, especially when they're shown this beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm cool with that. Would they have to go see it in the theater?
No.
just as long as you see it sometime. That's probably how I describe War Horse. I was like, I feel like this movie deserves to be watched because it's one of the most beautiful films at points that I've seen ever, but don't really need to see it a second time and didn't really need to see it in the theater.
Yeah, I'll see it. I know I'm going to see it once in my life, so I got time, hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully. We're not promised tomorrow, Clay.
I know. Thank you, Solomon, for your second appearance.
Oh, Blaine, any final thoughts?
No, I mean, similarly, if it's something you're interested in, it's worth seeing. And then soon after you see it, if you haven't done this before, you need to go find Marty Ritz, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold. Great Cold War film. And watch that soon after you watch Bridge of Spies. That'll even clarify. Sorry.
You said after?
After, before, before and after.
Watch it in general proximity.
Either way. And I think it's on Criterion, so you can probably find it on Hulu Plus. But I think maybe even watching those two, if you haven't seen The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, it might shed in a different light or cast in a different light some of the conversations we've been having about what some Cold War films do and how they sort of tackle the subject matter in a bleaker way.
I need to see it. That's one of the classics I haven't seen, so.
It's fantastic.
Mine is not on the Criterion Collection, but I'm gonna once again say go see The Majestic if you haven't seen it with Jim Carrey. Also, Jeffrey DeMunn and Laurie Holden, you Walking Dead fans, they had been together back in the 90s before they were Crazy Eyes Dale and another female lead destroyed by Kirkman's machine.
Mm. Oh,
Andrea.
The Walking Dead.
Anyway, The Spy Who Came From the Cold is on my list now. Thanks, Blaine.
Yeah.
And I'll make sure I put those in the show notes too, so people will be like, why is this linked here? I should check it out. Which is how I imagine people say when they see show notes. They
just like tickle their chin and go,
I wonder what this is.
You know, you'd mentioned Mikey, this movie could have been a miniseries. I'm super excited because next year, unless something falls through, which I hope it doesn't, they're doing I think it's AMC's pick up the rights in the U.S. It's a mini series adaptation of John Le Carre's The Night Manager, and I believe Tom Hiddleston and Hugh Laurie are set to star in it. And it's directed, at least the first episode I know, is directed by Suzanne Beer, who is a really, really talented Danish filmmaker.
Hmm.
So I'm super, super excited about that. I hope we actually get it.
Now I have too many things to put in the show notes. Yep, The Night Manager. Look at that. Mr. Tom Hiddleston is Jonathan Pine. Well, that's interesting. What's it about? Oh, wait, night manager of a European hotel is recruited.
It's been years since I've read that.
Nice. Oh, this is good spy stuff. No one else realized that this is like, this seems like the year of like the spy or the espionage kind of deal. Like, we've got so many, like.
Spectre.
Yeah. I mean.
Man from U.N.C.L.E. Mm-hmm. Mission Impossible. What was the other one?
Spy.
Spy. I've seen them all.
There's one called Our Kind of Traitor, which is also adapted from Le Carre, that's supposed to hit theaters, at least in the UK, this week, I think.
We got the Kingsman.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Gosh, what else did we get this year? Anyway.
Did we say Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Yes, we did. Yeah. I think Paddington, as everyone remembers, was a very
and Trumbo is from the era. I think the point of the movie is that Trumbo was not a spy, but interesting to see what that one does for sure.
Yeah, technically, American Ultra was kind of like that. Secret agent-y kind of weird something. So I mean, like already, and then I want to say we have something else come out, but off the top of my head, I can't remember. So it just seems like more than usual we're getting these spy things. So I wonder what that's saying. Anytime we get like a string of movies, it always makes me think like what's going on in the psyche of either writers or studios that says people want to watch these kind of movies right now. So maybe people just want to be cool and have guns and do backflips and shoot people. Sometimes it's that simple. Transition. Speaking of simple, how simple would it be to follow the things that you do on the internet, Clay?
It's simple, but it's a little difficult lately because I haven't been very prolific for a couple months. So you can find my older stuff, but no. I'm Clay Morgan PA on Twitter. The best place to go to find me is NorvalRogers.com. And that is a website that I share with Matt Michalotis and J.R. Forresteros. And also we have the Storymen podcast at storymen.us. And we've interviewed some pretty cool people. And as you know, Mikey, we just released our interview with George R.R. Martin, which was a super fun opportunity we had on the set of Z Nation season 2 to play around with the showmakers and to bump into George Martin when he was doing his cameo as a zombie in episode 8.
Very nice. And so I would highly recommend everyone listen to that, including myself, who has it downloaded on my phone, ready to listen to, and still haven't found time to do it because I'm terrible at listening to podcasts, which I hope no one else is, because hopefully you're listening to this. So Blaine, how can people follow what you do, follow you, interact with you, bother you, send you free Chinese food, whatever?
It's really simple. You can find me on Twitter at DEPT_of_tourism, which also has a spy connection, if anybody's wondering. And you can find me writing reviews here at Real World Theology. And then occasionally, it's been a long time, but I will write at realthinking.wordpress.com.
Awesome. And if anyone should be interested for whatever reason, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. And as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it, or even if you've not enjoyed it. I think you should subscribe either way. It's probably a good thing to do. So we're so grateful for our guests for being here, the history lessons and the very educational conversations that we've had. So please follow Clay. Please follow Blaine. Tell them what a great job they've done. Tell them how you're way smarter for having listened to them. And meanwhile, we are thankful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. So until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Texas is just a whole other place where people were very proud. I've just learned now that when I'm engaging a Texan about any topic that I haven't yet spoken with the person about, I just get it right out of the way. And they're like, oh, have you heard about? I just say, no, but I bet it's the best, biggest ever. And they're like, yeah, it is. Like, you know about it. I'm like, no, but tell me.
Just a guess.
Just tell me more. And they're like, well, it's the best and biggest ever. I'm like, oh, okay. Didn't see that coming.
Speaking of, so this is Blaine. He is the best and biggest ever.
Nice.
No pressure.